Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today on the show, we've got a discussion of the latest film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Black Widow. Marvel superfan Donovan Thompson from Podcast 241 joins me for that discussion. And then, in the back half of the show, I'm very excited that we're starting a new series looking at the films of Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai. Omaya Jones is back, and we're going to marathon through the entire Criterion box set that came out last year, starting with the film As Tears Go By. Stick around.
You don't know everything about me. I've lived a lot of lives. Before I was an Avenger. Before I got this family. I made mistakes. Choosing between what the world wants you to be. And who you are. Go back to where it all started.
Where did you think I was all this time?
We have unfinished business.
That was the trailer for Black Widow, the new MCU film starring Scarlett Johansson and Florence Pugh. A quick note about this podcast. We talk about arthouse movies, but as you can see, we talk about big blockbusters too. Honestly, I felt a little sheepish about this at first. I thought, am I really going to do a Marvel movie and a Wong Kar-wai movie in the same episode? In the past, I've done really big movies like Black Widow as bonus episodes, since they don't really fit under the umbrella of arthouse at all. But the more I thought about it, the more I decided to kind of embrace the diversity of these two films. My mission with this podcast has always been to try and encourage people to engage with movies that are more on the arthouse side of things. In fact, that's where I came up with the title. Arthouse Garage was meant to bring the arthouse world, which can be kind of snooty and snobby, down to earth. From the cinema to the garage, if you will. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized, what better way to bring these two worlds together than to talk about a big movie right before something smaller and more niche. And Wong Kar-wai may be especially fitting because, as you'll hear in the second half of the episode, he's a filmmaker that sort of embodies this exact thing. His films are a mixture of high and low art in a way. They embrace a style that is really in line with popular cinema, but at the same time, his films are richly created and incredibly well respected in the film world. So, if you thought it was a little weird to put these two movies together in a single podcast episode, so did I. But I decided to run with it, and I actually think it works really well, and I'll probably continue to do this sort of thing going forward. Something big and something small. Something popular right next to something arthouse. I really love movies on both ends of that spectrum, and I don't think I'm alone in that. And, just maybe, I'll get a few Marvel fans to check out a Wong Kar-wai film. Okay, back to Black Widow. This one's a bit unique for a few reasons. It's one of only two woman-led Marvel movies. It also jumps back in the timeline, as we'll discuss, and the lead doesn't actually have superpowers. So, does all of this make for a satisfying superhero movie? Keep listening and find out. My guest today is Donovan Thompson from Podcast 241. They do movie reviews, nerd stuff, even toy reviews. You can find all that good stuff over at their website, which is 241studios.com. I will link that in the show notes. Donovan is one of the biggest Marvel nerds I know, so I was thrilled when he said he'd come on the show to talk about this one. And as I hoped, he has many, many interesting thoughts about Black Widow. Donovan Thompson, welcome back to the podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Doing very well. And I'm so excited to have you back on the show. Yeah. The last time we talked, it was about Parasite, which is a great movie.
Parasite. We're going the opposite direction now.
Yeah, seriously. So. This is a little more like what you usually talk about on your podcast with the comic book nerd kind of stuff. I say that in love, of course.
This is right up my alley. This is... I live and die by anything comic related. So yeah, I'm excited.
Yes. So you're the perfect person to have on for this. So yeah, let's talk about Black Widow. So this is the latest in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's centered around the character of Black Widow, of course, who's one of the Avengers. We've seen her in several things. If you've seen all of the Avengers movies, which I think it's safe to assume most people have at this point in the last Avengers Endgame. Spoiler alert for that if you haven't watched it. But she does not make it out of that movie. So this film is kind of previously in her timeline, and we kind of fill in some gaps about what she was doing, which was a kind of a fun aspect of it, I thought. So we kind of meet her. We learn a lot about her past, meet her family, quote unquote family, which is kind of an interesting story. And there's a whole action movie plot that we get into, and we'll get into some of that as we discuss it here. Before we get into Black Widow, I was curious just to get a feel for your kind of MCU fandom. Do you have two or three movies in the MCU that you consider your favorites, or have you done a ranking, or what's your
bias? Yeah. Well, here's to show you my fandom. So, well, here's what I did on Sunday. I have a Letterboxd account, as I assume all film aficionados do, right?
Yes.
And on this Letterboxd account, I have all the MCU movies in like a narrative order. And so, but I took it a step further. I was like, because Black Widow came out, and I was like, okay, obviously this is in between Civil War and Spider-Man Homecoming. There's a 6-month gap there. And I was like, let's take it a little step further. So I started going in, plugging in the Marvel one-shots, plugging in like, okay, I know that like Iron Man 2, Incredible Hulk, and Thor take place during what's called Fury's Big Week, and like what scenes take place where. And so like I have notes. If you go through this letterbox list of like really whatever, however it plays out, I have it laid out for you all the way up until Loki. So it's pretty comprehensive, I think. And anyway, that shows you my MCU fandom.
There you go. Is that a public list? Can we kind of share that out? Absolutely. Yeah, I'll find that, put in the show notes. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I have like over 1,000 comic books, like single backed issues. Wow. And I've been collecting them my whole life. I liked Iron Man before people who knew who Iron Man was.
Yeah.
So I'm in it to win it sort of thing, you know.
The original fan. Well, that's great. Yeah, I've always thought it'd be cool if someone like took all the Marvel movies and cut them like in chronological order, like basically what you're talking about, but like actually edit this together into a super, super long like film experience.
That would be pretty cool. I want to do it. One thing I'm considering, this is the totally opposite, different universe here. I'm considering going in. I thought about it day one, actually, but going in and recutting Zack Snyder's Justice League, because I have like, I know I can cut off a good 15 to 30 minutes there and not lose anything. So anyway, to kind of go back and answer your question, favorite MCU movies. This one's a hard one, but I will say the first thing that comes to my mind when someone asks me that, and I kind of go to more, not my favorite, maybe the best. And I think the best MCU movie could be Captain America, the Winter Soldier.
All right.
And like at least solo outing. And I remember when I watched that movie, it just rocks my world. And there's so many, not just on a nerd level, but there's so many filmmaking things that are happening in that movie that I just adore.
Yeah.
And the other one I would say, of course, is Avengers Infinity War. It is currently the record for me for most viewings in a theater. Really? I saw it seven times.
Nice.
And I remember, just even when I watch it now, I've seen it a lot, but I'm in awe when I watch it. Yeah. And my last one I'll mention is, of course, Avengers Endgame. And why that one's special, obviously it's the culmination of 20 at this point in time, 22 movies. But I get emotional watching this stuff. And I was losing my mind during this movie. Like 5 minutes in, there's a close up of Captain America's eye, of him just looking at, like, you see the reflection of space in his eye. And I was losing it in the theater. Like little things like that, I was losing it. So that movie alone wrecks me. So if a movie makes me cry, it automatically just starts jumping up in the echelon of what I consider a great movie. So maybe those three are really special to me for numerous reasons. But yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I really like all the ones you mentioned about Captain America. Winter Soldier is up there for me. It's not in my like top five or anything, but I really like the whole paranoid thriller thing they do. It kind of feels almost like a 70s movie in some ways. Yeah, that one's really cool.
Definitely like Condor and like, yeah, 70s spy thrillers. Mm-hmm. Very much a Robert Redford. I mean, well, he's in it, obviously, but it's definitely, you know, that tone there. Do you have, you said not your top five. Do you have a favorite one? Like, what's your favorite?
I actually tried to do a ranking, and it's like, it's not finalized. I don't know. It's so hard for me to rank things. But when I like pulled out like my top three to five or so, the first one that popped into my head was actually Captain America Civil War. I really love the... It's kind of one of the really ensemble ones that's not an Avengers movie. We meet Black Panther in that one. We meet Spider-Man in that one. So I just really have always liked that one. And I like the whole the fighting aspect, the Civil War aspect of it, which I know a lot of comic fans were disappointed because in the comics, Civil War is like a much bigger deal. And you know, in this one, we have a fight scene between like 10 characters. But I really like that. And like, I love like when Ant-Man gets to meet Tony Stark and like those fun moments.
War rocked my world. I mean, like, my buddy who's Matt Mitchell, who's also on our channel a lot, who does you know, his 2-for-1 collector's bit. If you ask him, a lot of times he says Captain America Civil War. And if someone says that to me, like what you just said, I can't argue with you. Like, I think it might have just maybe structurally some things that I think Winter Soldier may outpace it with, but just in terms of spectacle and that airport fight, I mean, Spider-Man's my favorite like fictional character of all time. So obviously I was really excited for that. And Chadwick Boseman, you know, he nailed Black Panther.
So yes, love Captain America Civil War. The other ones that I filled out in my top five, they're just like exceptionally really good ones. Guardians of the Galaxy, I really like the first one of those. The first Avengers I think is really cool. I really enjoy that. It's almost hard to put like Avengers Endgame and the others up against these like solo movies because they're so different. I was like, I want to put Endgame way up at the top, but like, it's just such a different movie. I don't know. So I really like Endgame 2, but I didn't put it in my top five. Then I really like Black Panther and then Spider-Man Homecoming. So I'm also a big Spider-Man fan, and I really like that take on it. And I thought that first Spider-Man one was really, really good.
Are you excited for No Way Home?
I am, yeah. And I didn't love Homecoming, actually. Homecoming, the second one. I'm blanking on the name. Far From Home. Yes, I need to watch it again, but I was a little underwhelmed by it. So, but yeah, all the things that are buzzing out there about what might happen in it are pretty exciting. So, yes, very much looking forward to that one. Which,
my head's going to put it. If any of those rumors are true, my head is going to literally explode in the theater. So it's just, you know, it'll be wild. I'll be so excited. Yeah, no, the first Spider-Man movie, I consider it with Tobey Maguire 2002. Mm-hmm. I consider it like it depends on the day someone asked me, but it could be my favorite movie of all time. I don't know.
Wow.
So if he's in it, which, you know, it all signs point to yes, then I will. Yeah, I don't know what I'll do, honestly.
Just die of happiness right there in the theater.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I think I remember seeing at some point, maybe on the Facebook post or something, that you were not a big fan of Captain Marvel. So I thought I'd see, you know, as far as, first of all, is that true? And then second of all, this is another kind of woman-led Marvel movie. Did this one work better for you?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a fan of Brie Larson's Captain Marvel.
Okay.
I like the movie. I think it's well made. I like the structure of it. I like the way we flash back and forth. I even like the way in which, you know, we get into the action media rest, and then we basically are throughout the whole movie are getting, you know, these flashbacks of her and stuff. And I love the 90s nostalgia. Mm-hmm. My other favorite movie that's on any given day is True Lies. And there's a Blockbuster and there's a True Lies marquee in that theater, in that Blockbuster. And automatically, like, I like the movie because of that one shot. And Samuel Jackson, the de-aging in that is, I think, the best of all time. Mm-hmm. And so I could just watch the movie just for him alone in it. The problem all the things about it, I really like, I really do. There's only a couple things I don't like, but in terms of just Captain Marvel herself, it's really Brie Larson. And it's not like I have a problem, I think, with Brie Larson. Like, she's in The Room. She's in Short Term 12. She's a great actress. Mm. I think it was the script, or, I mean, if you look at it script-wise, technically she doesn't know who she is. She's a Kree, and she's kind of trying to figure out, you know, she's relearning that she's a human, right? And you do see her having fun in these flashbacks with Captain Rambo and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But something about her attitude, like, she's just not a likable superhero to me. I don't know what it is, but I just cannot get behind her. And I don't know, man. Something about her bothers me. But Black Widow, spoiler alert, I really like this movie a lot. And I've always liked Scarlett Johansson and everything. And I mean, Lost in Translation, it's fantastic. She's amazing.
Interesting. Well, I really like Captain Marvel because of Brie Larson. So we're just going to differ. Really? Yeah, I just really like her. I mean, I like her in other stuff too. But I just think she's like, I don't know, she's really badass. I just think she's cool.
She's badass, but I don't know. There's just something I can't figure it out yet. But I don't have to be a hater or anything.
Any idea of like the character from the comics? So I wonder if there's any like not matching up there that bothered. I don't know. I'm diagnosing.
I mean, not really. I mean, please. No, they're. I know this that, and this happens with comics in general, is that when a movie comes out, you see it being teed up in the comics already, because obviously if it's happening on the screen, there's more awareness than people might potentially buy the comic out in stores, like, oh, Captain Marvel, X, Y, and Z. And I do know that whenever, we got wind of Captain Marvel joining the MCU and the big announcement at I think it might've been Comic-Con. It wasn't D23 yet with Brie Larson. Obviously Marvel Comics started pushing Captain Marvel pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And she actually heads up Civil War II arc with Iron Man versus Captain Marvel. Oh, that's what that was about.
I know that. Wow.
And even then in the comics, she's not even that great. But I don't know. I don't think it's the character. I think it's just that portrayal of the character,
about that performance or something.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Yeah, I don't know.
Let's talk about Black Widow because I really like this movie as well. So I think for me, I kind of heard this comparison before. It's like, oh, it's like a Marvel version of a Jason Bourne movie, and that comparison really goes and goes. Like, there's a lot of Jason Bourne-esque things here. We got the mind-controlled assassins. We've got a car chase that feels very much like a Bourne movie. There's even a moment, so like in one of the Bourne movies, there's like an assassination attempt, but then there's a child present, and that kind of affects the scene. There's a scene like that in this too that goes a different way, which is interesting. But there's a lot of that. There's a lot of kind of James Bond feeling things, and then even some Mission Impossible-esque things happening. So it kind of, I think it makes a nice little swirl of all these other action movies, and which it's unique enough from other MCU movies, I think, too, like in the way it's a little bit smaller scale, which makes sense for someone without superpowers. And I was a fan of it. I like the vibes of it. And I did have a few issues with the ending, which we'll get to, which actually, by the way, I didn't mention this ahead of time. I think we can keep this spoiler free and just kind of talk around some things. But yeah, I had a few things I didn't love about the end of this movie, but mostly I was all in on this. Yeah.
Gotcha. I was fixing to just spill out the ending right there. I'm so glad that you said that. You're right. This feels like a homage of a lot of different genres here. I say genres, more like franchises. And you bring up the Bourne one. It's funny because me, Daniel, and Bruce on our podcast a couple months ago, we broke down the first Bourne movie and we talked about the Bourne franchise kind of at large and their place in the early 2000s and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And yes, absolutely. When you're watching it, there is moments of Bourne. I say that one thing I'll say about that is I kept waiting for like a zoom in shot of a guy at a desk on a computer and like it whipping around to another guy. Like, I kept waiting for that, but then they never did it. And I was actually kind of disappointed. But here's another genre. Here's another franchise in here that you didn't mention that I really think it does almost even more so, which is Terminator.
Okay.
And Taskmaster is basically the Terminator. It's the T-800. And you get Terminator meets Bond meets a little bit of Jason Bourne in there. And here's another thing that the first thing I thought of when the movie started was this. It starts on this flashback scene, right, in the 80s. It was immediately the Americans with Kerry Russell and Matthew Rice and Reese. I'm not sure how he says his last name. And that show's incredible. It's on FX and it won a lot of Emmys. And it's all about a Russian family, in the 80s, disguised as an American family and that kind of stuff. And I was really I love that show, and I thought, you know, I was excited about this, just all these different things that the MCU is trying to do. I will say that it trying to emulate a lot of these different franchises, and there's even a little bit of Ocean's 11, and I guess you could even maybe do, yeah, and maybe in Ocean's, maybe you said Mission Impossible, maybe it's more Mission Impossible, but some, how they do some narrative things at the very end, it feels like they don't have a total, like, tonal thing. They keep kind of jumping back from different things, and it's like a homage. It's more like it's honoring this franchise, which there's nothing wrong with that. I still enjoyed it heavily, but I kind of would like an alternate movie where they just went full-blown Mission Impossible or full-blown Jason Bourne and really kind of, you know, really went deep into one of these genres, but, or these franchises. But no, I think it's overall, I mean, it was a really cool movie. I mean, I love the opening scene, obviously. The opening credits is obviously kind of like it's, you know, the 90s, 80s, 90s opening credits, but it's definitely got that, like, a James Bond kind of feel, but without the artistic part of it. You know what I'm saying? Like, it doesn't have silhouettes and, like, a beautiful kind of thing, right? But it has this 90s kind of montage that we just don't get in movies anymore, right? We just normally just start. And
I was going to mention those credits too. Those are like, there's like newsreel political images happening, and we're kind of like learning, just seeing flashes of it. And the music is so cool. It's this cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit. I looked it up. It's by Malia J. That's really cool. But yeah, I was going to mention that too. Okay, go on.
It's originally a Nirvana song. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. And but it has that punk, absolutely that punk feel to it. And it does make the movie feel total, like, just having that alone makes it feel like a different, like, at least it's worth its spot in the MCU, because it's carved out a little niche there that none of the other movies have done yet. Yeah. So I will say that it's earned its place for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to mention those credits. That opening sequence I thought was really great. I have not watched The Americans, but I've heard it's incredible. So this isn't making me want to watch it again.
Man. If you like that opening scene, that is the whole show, but like 10 times more intense. So you will,
like it. That's kind of what I wanted. I was like, wow, I could like stay in this world a little longer and learn more about what's going on. But exactly what I should do. Yeah. I think the director, Kate Shortland, did a great job with those opening credits. Gives you quite a kind of an opening thing. I haven't seen anything else that she's directed. I'm looking on her IMDb, but definitely going to be watching her going forward. But yeah, there's some other really nice touches, some of my kind of just favorite moments. There's one moment, so there's like the car chase that happens. There's like a tank, basically the villains in a tank, Taskmasters, and there's a moment where I only seen it the once, but there's a great moment when we don't see the tank yet, but we see the effect of it. Like, we see cars like smashing their direction, and then the camera whips over and we see the tank. Oh, that was a really cool little reveal. And then there's a lot of fun little character things too. I want to talk about Florence Pugh for sure, because she's absolutely my favorite.
She's on my list for she's like my probably number one, not number one favorite thing, but maybe my favorite thing. But I do want to go back to your tank thing real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's something that it's interesting you brought that up, because I found that really cool too. It's something that, even though people give him a lot of shit, and rightfully so probably overall, but Michael Bay does. And Michael Bay has this penchant of basically showing you the reactions of characters, and you don't really see what they're looking at, but through like maybe something in the background or something happening, it makes the world feel so much larger. And it makes the chaos feel so much bigger, and you're not even seeing, you know, Pearl Harbor being bombed. You're not seeing Optimus Prime being thrown around yet. Yeah. You're just seeing these people's reactions. And it's something that, you know, it's obviously they're different, you know, even shots and whatever, but it's something I think is cool when filmmakers do that, where they're basically showing you the effect and not the cause. And it makes the world just feel, I don't know, it's just something about it that I think is really cool, and you don't see it all the time, but when it happens, I think it's cool. Yeah,
it's a cool way to like kick off that car chase.
Yeah, for sure.
Only other like favorite moment I want to talk about was, there's a moment where Florence Pugh is talking to her. She's kind of like teasing her a little bit, and she talks about the Avengers, and she's like, oh, and you know, like the big ones, and like as if Black Widow is not one of the big ones, you know, and that was, I feel like a little bit of fan service almost, because that's kind of how she might be thought of. It's like, oh, we have these superheroes, and then we have, you know, these humans with Hawkeye and Black Widow, who are just maybe not the major ones. It was funny that she brought that in, the fun little touch.
No, yeah, no, it's a nice little jab there at her, and it's even more of a meta commentary, just people debating, all of us nerds, like, you know, why is she there? She, you know, she can only do this, or why is Hawkeye there? He only has arrows. Like, it's a great little thing, but obviously she definitely earns that in Endgame and even in all the other movies, of course. But one thing I want to say, my favorite moments or favorite things about it is the opening fight with Taskmaster with Widow, their first encounter.
It's and on the bridge there.
Yeah, and I brought up the Terminator reference. Mm-hmm. Terminator is one of my favorite franchises of all time, and it's just cool seeing like a unstoppable force, and especially someone who's acrobatic and using swords, and even mimicking other Avengers like Black Panther and Captain America and all these others. Really cool. Now I do have problems with Taskmaster. We'll talk about that a little bit, but. I know, I really like that opening fight, and Florence Pugh as Yelena, she was great. I mean, it's one of those things, like, you know, it definitely feels like, and it's understandably so, that Marvel is passing the torch from characters to others, and you never know how it's going to go, and you're kind of always nervous, like, will this person, you know, at least, you know, take the mantle and make it their own, and or, you know, be a good replacement, and I think she will be. She's very fun. And like even the joke about, you know, superhero poses and landings, like that's a great gift that's even floating around now. And she has a lot of charm to her. And now I'm excited to see where she goes next, which I think obviously if you watch the movie, you know where she's going next.
And I second all of that. She's so incredible. Like, I think I first saw her in Midsommar and then in Little Women. Like, she's like the best part of every movie she's in, it seems like. So I'm really excited.
She's in Midsommar.
Yeah. Oof, man, that's an intense one. But
that movie, Katie can't. I think the opening 5 minutes of that movie like scarred her.
It's rough. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty rough.
I had seen Hereditary, so I kind of knew what I was getting into, but yeah. Like, oh, damn.
I did too. Ari Aster. Is his name Ari Aster?
Yeah.
I'd love to have like coffee with him and just say, man, what's going on with you? Like,
you okay, man?
let's figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Florence Pugh, so incredible. I wanted to mention the costumes in this. I think are really cool. So, like, not only the superhero costumes, like she, I think it's new to this movie. I think she wears this white leather, Black Widow does, and Florence Pugh does as well. Just a really cool costume, and then the costuming kind of comes into the plot a little bit at the end without spoiling anything there. Then Rachel Weisz has a cool leather thing too, but just like even their. The, like everyday civilian clothes, like when we first meet Florence Pugh in the apartment and then they end up running around and having this car chase, she's just wearing this gray blazer and she's just, I don't know, she just looks so fierce. And I was like, this is incredible. I just love watching her run around and like kick ass in her everyday clothes. Yeah. All day long. And that seems like what we hopefully are going to get, you know, with more of later on down the road.
No, you're right. And this brings up a point, something I've been kind of thinking about. And you mentioned the fact that the clothing, we're trying to be spoiler free here. It ties into where we see, Black Widow in Endgame, right? Mm-hmm. And it adds more context and even a little more heartbreaking in some ways. And what this movie really does that I did like a lot, and it really kind of fleshes out some, it's, you know, obviously all her stuff, but it makes the world feel more lived in, even more believable. And it's not like it's not telling these giant big strokes. I mean, this is kind of a small. I mean, the stakes are large, yes, but it's really not at the same time. Not compared to a Thanos or you know, a Loki or someone like that. And it really, like, example, we have like they keep bringing up Budapest. So basically, we keep hearing about this, and I was convinced, like, oh, we're going to have Jeremy Renner back in this, spoiler, he's not in it. Jeremy Renner back in it, and we're going to see a flashback of Budapest. But they were smart because they keep building up this moment between these two characters, and it's almost never going to live up to what how they feel about it, right? Because we're just going to look at it, you know, objectively. But what they did was, what I thought was smart, was they were referencing it in ways that, A, I felt were very natural to the plot, but also it made it feel like, oh man, this thing was kind of intense. Like, we do visit the safe house that they, yeah, you know, were using. We do visit this hiding spot that Hawkeye and Black Widow used after the Budapest mission. Mm-hmm. And it all really, you know, and there's other things plot-wise, obviously, that really tie into the villains here, but it made it feel like the Marvel Cinematic Universe is deeper than even these, you know, multiverse shattering events,
yeah,
which is a really nice thing that I really like.
Yeah. Speaking of Loki there with the multiverse, the just finished that the other night, and man, that was crazy. But yeah, I agree with you on all that. And I think it, you're right. We get like more information about Budapest without just seeing it play out. And I think you're right. That's a good way to handle that. Yeah.
The last thing I'll say that I really liked was the Moonraker reference. This is why I like Scarlett Johansson better than I like Brie Larson, because she just seems like, I don't know, she's just so charming. ScarJo is, no matter what, like, you just hang out with her, you know. But she's in the one, she's like in her little trailer or whatever, she's watching Moonraker.
Oh, and that's what that was. So yes.
Yeah, right. Which is a Bond movie, right, with Roger Moore. And this is, I wouldn't say this is spoilers. I mean, you've seen the trailer, you know, this ain't super spoilery, but the final location is also in the air, above airspace, mm-hmm, close to space, just like Moonraker. It's the same way Moonraker ends, right, too.
I knew that was a James Bond reference, but I haven't seen all of them. So I was like, I know one of those. I know from playing the N64 games, like, one of these locations is a lot like this.
And there's something, so I don't know what it is, but her watching that, I think she's eating cereal or something, and she's like quoting the movie.
Yeah.
It's just, if you really think about all the scenes we've had with her, we don't have any of these personal moments like that. I think the closest we get with her, that's like any real moment, is probably an Endgame, whenever she's breaking down and Cap's there, you know, and they're having that little moment there, after their comms meeting with whoever, you know, Captain Marvel, Rocket Raccoon, whoever. But just having this moment where it's just her by herself, she's not a spy. And funny enough, she's watching a spy movie, but it's so humanizing. And that's the kind of thing I liked. I liked a lot about this movie. So,
yeah, I agree with that for sure. That was a nice moment. We don't get a lot of those like human things, you know, because she's been bred and like, you know, trained to not be very human, you know, like be inhuman in the way she's, you know, an assassin and all that. Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, even more importantly, she's by herself. You know, like every scene in the MCU, she's talking to Bruce Banner, she's talking to Iron Man, Thor, or you know, whatever. Yeah. Now she's literally by herself. And what does Black Widow do in her spare time? She eats cereal and she watches James Bond.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
I love it. Well, before we wrap up, I want to talk about, I did have a few issues with the ending, and one of them is just like kind of the issue that's always been around, and it's like, okay, in this world of superheroes, what do we do with these people who are not, you know, super? Mm-hmm. And often the answer is just make them incredibly lucky. there's a few things that were really kind of pushed the believability. Like for me, one was if you've seen the trailer, you know, there's like a skydiving sequence, and there's a moment in that where like she needs an extra parachute and there's some plane debris, and she like dives through an airplane and grabs it. And I was just like, okay, this is that's a little much. She would just be able to do that. So some of those kind of things bother me. But then also, I won't go into detail about this, cause again, I don't want to spoil it, but I'll just say the word pheromones that plays in, and in a way that I really thought was honestly kind of silly. That took me out of that. But one final thing before we wrap up is I did like won't spoil it, but there's always a post-credit scene, of course. But I think that the post-credit scene gives us a little bit of closure in a way that we didn't get in Avengers Endgame that I thought was nice. Even just a really small little thing that happens there. But
it does. I'll say this. I love Marvel. They have this penchant of taking a serious moment, and a lot of modern movies do this, and they take a serious moment and then they have to put a joke at the end of it. And I love Marvel. I'll die with Marvel, but I'm not a fan of that. It has its place, but not all the time. And they do that in that scene, which also I called that. I knew where it was leading, like last week in our podcast on 2 for 1. So you heard it here, people. Nice. I was
even the other character that's there. You called that.
Yes.
Nice. Wow.
Yes. I'll say this. I knew this scene was going to happen. I didn't with these characters. I just didn't know. I didn't know it was after credits, but I didn't know it was going to happen. And based on things that are happening in other places in the MCU, but it is nice. It does kind of feel. I mean, here's the real thing is that. We can't really talk about it. It's spoilers for other things. Okay. You know what? If you want my thoughts, you can check out my podcast.
Yes, go to podcast like 241. Next week. It's really great. Yeah,
I'll spoil the hell out of it for you. Yep.
Well, cool. Any final thoughts on Black Widow? I think it's been a good discussion.
Yeah, no, I think it is. I'm excited to. You know, it's weird because normally I watch a movie like 2-3 times the opening weekend. I just haven't had time yet.
Yeah,
it's not because I didn't enjoy it. I really enjoyed the movie. As always, I'm going to buy, just like Captain Marvel, the Steelbook Blu-ray when it comes out.
Nice. Yes, I'll definitely be streaming it again once it hits Disney in a few months.
For sure, yeah. No, I'm excited for it, and I'm excited to see where we go with the Black Widow mantra.
Yeah. Yes. Well, I guess we can wrap up there. Thank you so much, Donovan. I really appreciate you coming back, and it's always good to chat movies with you.
Yeah, of course. I'm excited to be back on, and you know, if you ever do your Justice League breakdown, just want to slam it or love it, I'll be there for both. So I'm down. Please do it.
All right. Well, until then, I guess we'll say bye-bye for now, and thanks again.
Bye.
Huge thanks to Donovan for coming on. I feel like I always learn something new about Marvel when I talk to that guy. And now from Marvel to something a little bit smaller. I've talked on this podcast many times about Criterion, the film distribution company that creates beautiful special edition Blu-rays and DVDs of significant films, and they come packed with supplements and special artwork. They also release box sets like the complete films of Agnes Varda or Ingmar Bergman's Cinema, and there's several more. There have long been rumors of a Wong Kar-wai box set, and the rumors finally proved true last year when they released The World of Wong Kar-wai, with 7 of his most significant films in a beautiful package with essays, artwork, and all kinds of things. If you've never heard of Wong Kar-wai, don't worry. We're going to give an introduction to who he is as a filmmaker in just a minute, as well as a breakdown of the first film in the box set, which is As Tears Go By. Over the next 6 episodes, we'll be watching all of the films and talking through each one, and I'm so excited to do that. Also exciting, I'll be joined by Omaya Jones for this entire series. If that sounds familiar, he's been on the show many times before, including for last year's series on contemporary Asian filmmakers. Omaya is a film podcaster himself and the programmer of the Arkansas Times film series, and he always has something interesting to say when it comes to cinema. Welcome back to the podcast, Omaya Jones. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing very well. It's been, when I got on Skype, which is how we usually record, it said last time we Skyped was 7 months ago. So I guess that's the last time you were on the podcast. We did contemporary Asian filmmakers last year. I didn't really plan this, but we're doing another Asian filmmaker. We're going to talk all through the Criterion Wong Kar-wai, the World of Wong Kar-wai box set that came out earlier this year. Is that right? Was it 2021 or was it last year? It was last year when it came out.
Yeah.
Yes.
After the last Criterion sale, which is why it took so long for me to get my hands on it.
That's right. You gotta wait for those 50% sales, which if you're listening quickly, it's still going on at the Barnes & Noble for the rest of July. You can get your half off all Criterions, including the big box sets like this one. This one, I know there was a ton of anticipation for years that one day there's going to be a Wong Kar-wai box set. And like I would see it in forums and stuff. Like, I'm still holding out for that Wong Kar-wai. And finally, it came last year. It was supposed to come early 2020, I think, or maybe late 2019. I can't remember, but it was delayed even then. But finally, it's here. 7 films. It's not all of his films. We'll talk a little bit about that. But it's 7 of his kind of most major works. So Omaya, before we kind of get into it, how many Wong Kar-wai films have you seen before? How many of these are going to be new to you? What's your kind of relationship with him?
Yeah, so I was actually thinking about this the other day, and I realized that the first Wong Kar-wai film I saw was a short he did for the Higher series. Are you familiar with those?
No, I know. So in the box set, there's a segment of something else, but this is something else you're talking about, right?
Right. So in the early 2000s, BMW did this promotion where they hired directors to make short films that featured their cars. And I think this was in like 2000 or 2002. And there were directors like Ong Lee and I think maybe like John Woo and Guy Ritchie did one. And one of them was done by Wong Kar Wai. And so when I was thinking about it, I realized that that was probably the first film of his that I saw. And then a few years later, I think I saw it in The Mood for Love on home video when I was in college. And so in terms of this box set, I think I've seen all of them except for the one that, well, I now I have seen As Tears Go By. Okay. Right. Yes. Yeah. And I have not seen Happy Together yet. So I'm excited to see that. Nor have I seen Ashes of Time, which is not in the box set, but I have seen My Blueberry Nights. So,
yes. Yeah. So that I'll answer my answer too. And then we can kind of talk through all of his movies and which ones are here. I had only seen Chungking Express before. I didn't know you'd seen so many. So, you're, as always, the person that I have as the guest is more of an expert than me. And so that's why I have such smart people on the podcast. But yeah, I saw Chungking Express. It was funny. I think I had read just a few synopses of his films. I'd heard of Wong Kar-wai, and he's like, oh, he's one of these filmmakers I need to know more about. But for some reason, I thought Wong Kar-wai was going to be more of an action. Chungking Express was going to be more of an action movie, and got into it. It's like, oh, that's not really what this is at all. So it was just a funny kind of experience, but I really loved it. I was really taken with the style of it. And I think that was 2 years ago or something. So I'm excited to get back into these. But yeah, I'd never seen In the Mood for Love. I've seen some kind of images from it, and I know it's, you know, one of the greats of all time. So I'm really excited to get to it. And I really, really liked As Tears Go By. So this is now my second Wong Kar-wai film to watch. So in the box set are seven films. They are As Tears Go By, Days of Being Wild, Chungking Express, Fallen Angels, Happy Together, In the Mood for Love, and 2046. So that's seven of them. There are some others. So since 2046, he has made two English language films, right? My Blueberry Nights, or just that one is English language.
Yeah, that one's English language. And then he did The Grandmaster.
Grandmaster, which is about Ip Man, right? It's a kung fu movie.
Right. And I was reading today that I guess when they started production of that, there were no other Ip Man films that had been released. But by the time he finished it, because it was like a 4-year process, Ip Man and Ip Man 2 had already come out. Oh, no. and a third one. So,
yeah. And now there's four or five of those, I think, right? So interesting. Yeah. It's a troubled production from what I hear on that one. But so there's that. And then you referenced it a moment ago.
Ashes of Time.
Ashes of Time, yes.
No, I have not seen that.
You've not seen it. Okay.
I have not. But I hope to see it before we're done with this, because why not?
I'm planning to kind of catch up with those others as well. I think all three of those that are not part of the box set are streaming. Although Ashes of Time, there's some controversy there, which maybe we can talk about later, but basically a lot of it, the original prints have been lost. So the version that's streaming online is called the Redux. And it's, from what I've read, everyone agrees it's not as good. And it's even missing some scenes or something like that. They've kind of tried to re-edit it, but it's not quite the same. So that's interesting as well. But so that one's not in the box set, but for the ones that are in the set, we're going to go through episode by episode, one film each, except we are going to double up once just so we can get through in six episodes. So we're going to start with As Tears Go By from 1988. Before we get to that, we are going to talk a little bit about just Wong Kar-wai, a little intro about who he is and why he's significant, and then a little bit about just this box set, because it's kind of interesting, just physical packaging and some of the things that are included with it. So I'll ask you, Amaya, what do you think, in your mind, why is Wong Kar-wai a significant filmmaker?
Yeah, I think, you know, he comes from the Hong Kong New Wave in the 80s. And there were a lot of those films that were genre films. There were crime films like As Tears Go By. But I think he sort of breaks out of the pack starting with his second feature. And he develops a style that's more about mood and tone and longing. Like develops this interest in these different themes that I think sets him apart from them. And it's weird, because I was thinking about how we spend a lot of time with these filmmakers that I guess were working or are well into their careers when we were still relatively young. And so in that aspect, it's interesting to go back. But you know, most of the directors from that time that has sort of broken out or stayed around are really known for like action and crime, like John Woo or Ringo Lam or some of those other directors. Mm-hmm. And he's just like a total like critics director, critical darling. Mm,
yeah. Yeah, that's kind of my understanding or my sense of him too, is just I hear the word longing a lot in reference to him. And that's definitely present in this first film and absolutely in Chungking Express. That was something that struck me. And yeah, just visually really incredible. There's an essay in the book in the box set that I have a few quotes from that kind of try to answer this question too. They talk about his, here's a quote, "a blend of pop exuberance and alienated melancholy." And I think even from this first film that comes through, like, the pop exuberance, absolutely. There's some great pop music included. And in Chungking Express, which I've seen, there's lots of that as well. And, there's something in their essay talked about people being critical of him early on, that he's had sort of an MTV aesthetic or something like that. I can't remember the exact words. That there's a music video-esque quality to some of these scenes, but yeah, there's so much more than that. There is such longing, the alienated melancholy, and there's a sense, definitely with Chungking Express, that's the melancholy was like overwhelming almost, but in a way that was, you know, like I couldn't get enough of at the same time. So I'm excited to revisit that. And I think that probably is something I'm going to sense in some of his other films as well. But then it also talked about, another quote was, it's a sensibility that is equal parts high and low. And so like there's a sort of a mix of, yeah, genre films like this crime thriller that we're going to talk about today. But also even within that, the high art of cinema, you can kind of see that he, even here in his first feature, had a real eye for cinema. And I can even see how this one was influential on some things I've seen in the last few years. I'm really excited to get into it. He's a very visual director. So I think that kind of sums up. And let me look at the name of the essayist who wrote here is named John Powers, who you may have heard on NPR. He's he's their critic at large is what his title is there. But he also wrote a book about Wong Kar-wai that is very difficult to get your hands on. I went to try to see how much a copy would be, and they're like going for $200 on eBay and stuff. Ooh. So maybe one day I'll have a copy of that, but not yet. But he's something of an authority on Wong Kar-wai, so and I like that he has the essay here in the book.
I think it's interesting, the idea are the references to MTV are apt, because it's definitely an influence. You know, I think MTV was big at the time. And America has always been such a big exporter of culture. And so as MTV was becoming a force in the 80s, it only makes sense that directors or people from around the world were sort of imbibing that spirit. And I know like he also has this interest in these nonlinear narratives or things where like, the plot structure is not necessarily the most important thing. And I think you'll see that we'll like see that more as we get into the box set. Whereas compared to his other films, As Tears Go By is relatively straightforward.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's a little bit about Wong Kar-wai. And I'm sure we'll kind of, as we go through, be touching on specific things in each film that kind of are through lines through his work, which is one of my favorite things to do with the director. So, but yeah, a little bit about his life. And this is mostly out of the essay as well. But I Googled a little bit. But so he was born in Shanghai in 1958. So he is from mainland China. I thought that was interesting. But then he moved to Hong Kong at the age of 5. And what's interesting about that is he was actually separated from his siblings for about 10 years. And so he was, I think, the only child that was able to go to Hong Kong at that time. And then the rest of his siblings came later. And so there's some speculation that may have something to do with the sense of alienation, the sense of loneliness sometimes that is present in his films. This noted that he was very close with his mother, and she loved films. They would go see films a lot. And then when he was getting into school and into his career, he actually studied graphic design. And I thought that seemed interesting as well. You know, hear about different directors studying different forms of art or having different careers before they became a filmmaker. And I'm always interested to hear those kind of things and see how it might affect their work. I remember hearing like Peter Greenaway was a an artist, like a visual artist, painter before he was a filmmaker, and that totally comes across in his movies. So, and I think, you know, thinking about to the MTV aesthetic or something, that graphic design somehow marries with that in an interesting way. And it kind of makes sense in a way, I think.
So I guess I hope I don't get this backwards, but I know like in Hong Kong, they speak, I think, Cantonese.
Yes.
Yes. And then on the mainland, they typically speak Mandarin. Mm-hmm. And so learning that was hard for him initially. Mm. And I think I remember reading that he didn't really learn Cantonese and English until he was in his teens. Mm. And so that was part of the reason that he was maybe not able to integrate fully with society initially.
Mm. That's interesting. Yeah. And again, that kind of alienated feeling is something that seems to really come into his work as well. He started working in TV, and there's a frequent collaborator of his is named William Chang Suk Ping, who is a designer and editor who worked on a lot of his films with him. So we may mention that name again as we go. But then as he kind of got into film, here's another quote from that essay, but it says, every one of his films not only responds to his life and his surroundings at the time that it was made, but it's also a reaction to the film that preceded it. So I'm really interested to see how that plays out in kind of thinking, okay, in 1988, this is what was happening in the world when this film came out. But then looking at the next film, what's going to, you know, kind of relate back or forward from film to film. That may be unique, at least somewhat unique among filmmakers, that sort of film to film connection.
Yeah. Have you read much into his shooting style that he's developed over time?
No.
It's very unconventional.
Tell us. To say the least.
So I know, I don't know necessarily about As Tears Go By, but one thing that happens is, especially when he starts working with Chris Doyle, who's the cinematographer that I think he's made six films with, and he worked on In the Mood for Love in 2046. And I think he started working with them actually with Chungking Express, but there may or may not be a script. Even if there is a script, it's more of a blueprint. Hmm. And he's writing as they film. Wow. And so it can be very improvisational, and the actors have the free rein to sort of create their characters and decide things. And as a result, what ends up happening is, just the amount of time it takes to shoot the films expands over time, which is why The Grandmaster had like a 4-year shooting schedule. I think 2046 also went on for 4 years, and The Mood for Love was a 15-month shooting schedule. Chungking Express is interesting because like it was shot in a 6-week period, very close to Ashes of Time, which went on for a period of time. And so it's like this, like a small sort of experimental film that he did really quickly as he was sort of trying to recover from this other more grueling experience.
Interesting. Yeah. And so, and speaking of 2046, I read a few really interesting things about the production there. So we'll talk about that once we get to that film, which will be in a few weeks down the road. But yeah, I think there's some interesting little anecdotes about productions kind of throughout his career. So let's talk about this actual physical box set. So the packaging is really interesting. So I have a few of these kind of Criterion sets, but this one, I remember seeing like images of the people that were getting it quickly when it first came out. And I was trying to figure out like, wait, how does this work? And it unfolds. It looks like a box, but it unfolds from the back into this large kind of irregular shape. And then the booklet and the book of discs are kind of nestled within there. The book that came with it is really interesting. So it has that essay I've been mentioning, and it has a bit about each film. But the pages are like a French cut, I think is the word for it, where basically they're like doubled over and there's like space in between, which just gives the whole book a really kind of a unique feel. It makes it feel very thick. But there's also these kind of halfway, I don't know, every few pages there's these still images almost on postcards that are in these sleeves you can pull out and look at. And there's lots of imagery throughout the whole thing. It's really a beautiful, beautifully put together set. Do you have any impressions on any of that, Omaya?
I do think it's a very beautiful, beautifully put together set. Maybe I'm just old. I don't understand why the box has to be so intricate.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot.
And And, you know, it's not as, in terms of like space, it doesn't demand as much as say like the Bergman,
right,
or the Fellini. But I don't know. I ended up wishing, I think, that it was like sturdier, a little, the packaging.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a hassle to open it up every time. I will say that.
Yeah. And the way the disc fold out as well. Like it's a beautiful thing to look at, but I don't think I want to handle it every day.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, so like the Bergman and the Varda are both like really straightforward. There's like almost like you'd see like a set of two books with a cardboard sleeve, but and that's one is discs and one is supplements. But then this one and the Fellini as well is really interesting. It's kind of like they have the kind of the circus theme with it, and it's got different shapes of book, but it's a little easier to use than this one too, I would say. It almost opens like a board game or something, the Fellini one. Anyway, that is it's a very unique physical item, so if you don't have it, it might be worth just looking up like a video online of it or something, because it's pretty interesting. So we talked about the films that are in there, and then it's got this essay and everything. There's also kind of an interesting little statement about the restoration process from Wong Kar-wai himself, and I won't read the whole thing, but I remember hearing, so forever there's people have been really anticipating this set, and then it comes out and some people are really disappointed, and I was like, what's going on? Because the restoration process that's happened here has changed some of these films, and we'll get into more of that as we kind of go through each one and kind of the specifics of each one. But in the book here, Wong Kar-wai has a statement. Basically he talks about, you know, he says he completed his more original vision. Like this is what he wanted it to be originally in some cases. And he also said he has there's an old proverb about, a man never steps in the same river twice because he's not the same man and it's not the same river. And so he's saying, you can think of the films in that way. They're organic and changing maybe. And how, I like that sentiment because there are films I've seen years ago and then revisited and had very different experiences with. But the actual films changing is maybe a little more unique, but tell us a little bit about that, the controversy around that and who Rich Rivada is and, some more about that. Oh my.
Right. So, I hope I don't butcher this, but imagine Retrovada is a restoration house that is based out of Italy. And in about 2015, they opened a China extension. And where I think what they mostly do there is they will scan, like digitally scan the film, and then send it to the Italy location to be restored. And so, you know, they do all sorts of various processes to restore film. That can range from just, you know, taking the original negative and scanning it at a higher rate, like a 2K or 4K or what have you, to going in and erasing cigarette burns, to cleaning them up, to like doing really extensive restorations. But the key thing is that people have noticed, and there are a couple of these restoration houses where this seems to be an issue, where at some point in the process, there is a distinctive color grading added to it. And so a lot of times you'll see this with films. Like I know with the King Hu films that Criterion released, Retrovada were the restoration house behind those. That's like Touch of Zen and I forget the name of the other one, but they have a yellow tint to them. And so one thing that people have noticed is that if you look at like those films or I think some Tati films or some other things that they've done, they all have a similar yellow tint to them, which indicates that it's something more that there's something uniform going on to the way that they work and their process and their workflow and not just the whims or the desires of a particular filmmaker or a particular person. With the Wong Kar-wai set, the issue is especially within the Mood for Love. There's some green. They're a lot more green than they are. But this all goes back to like a debate among cinephiles and restoration houses about sort of what their job and what their role is. And I think as things have become digital and it's easier to work, it's easier to alter things. You see this happening more and more. Another example would be like Michael Mann's Thief. People noticed that at some point he went back and now it's very blue. Like they kicked out the blue. Mm-hmm. And then depending on like how in the nitty gritty you want to get, like grain is a thing. I remember when I first upgraded to a Blu-ray player, going on Blu-ray.com forums and seeing people talk about grain removal. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of, I think, Warner Brothers DVDs and things like Predator, where the grain removal was such that the figures were completely smooth and waxy. And then there's a debate where whether or not, because grain is something that's inherent to the film and therefore outside of the filmmaker's control, it's something that you should do something about if you have the opportunity to or not. There's a whole thriving debate around these issues that I think Richard Vada and Criterion just sort of stumbled into.
Yeah.
And it has sort of been bubbling underneath the surface for a while, but with something this high profile, it seems like they just kicked the hornet's nest.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. So I read first around like, okay, yeah. So In the Mood for Love looks different in this set, and it's not the same as when you buy the Blu-ray standalone or the DVD standalone from Criterion, and it looks worse. Some people are saying it looks worse, not as good, whatever. And then I saw some people comparing it to like when George Lucas made the special edition of Star Wars and added a bunch of CG things that looked really bad, and people are like, this is like the art house version of the special edition of Star Wars, and he's ruining his own films. And it's very hotly debated online. I was like, oh wow, I didn't know this was such a big issue. And maybe as we go through the films that it's really affected, I know there are people have put like side-by-side comparison shots and things, so we can kind of link to those and look at those ourselves. I don't feel like I have a real strong opinion one way or the other at this point anyway. It'll be interesting to see if that kind of develops, but I've always just thought, okay, whatever the director wants to do, right? And Wong Kar-wai supervised this, so but apparently it's not quite that simple. We know with the restoration house and everything, so that's another layer that's going to be interesting to kind of follow as we watch through these. But
I think the concept that you hear expressed is that the goal should be to maintain what they call the historically relevant version. Which is typically the version that's released in theaters. And what that means is, or at least the way I take it to mean is, if you're someone 20 years from now and you're reading contemporary reviews from a film's release, you ought to be able to see a version of the film that corresponds with what they saw and what they're writing about. And a big thing that people are actually asking for is just maintaining the option to have every version like of the
multiple
film
versions. Yeah.
Right. And so like, in this case where it gets difficult is yes, you can buy, you can still buy the standalone disc for In the Mood for Love. And in fact, when they started talking about the changes, I already had it on DVD, but I went ahead and upgraded to the single disc Blu-ray, just to have it just in case. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the Chungking Express disc is out of print. And so unless you want to spend $100, it's not really an option.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting thing too to consider like the role of physical media in this, because that's the best way to kind of preserve different versions of things. Because so like with Star Wars as an example, there was I know people on the internet like did the kind of, they call it the despecialized edition, like they've kind of undone the special edition things and try to create that historically relevant version. Like this is as close to what you can get as what played in the theater back in the day. And then you look at how streaming is now, and like in 50 years, the going version of Star Wars is whatever's going to be on Disney Plus, right? That's the access people are going to have to things. And so, and they've already made changes to it. And so that is an interesting problem that, if these corporations are controlling the art in that way, then they can kind of do whatever they want. Anyway, well, that's a whole other can of worms, but I think that's a really interesting layer to Wong Kar-wai and to this set in particular. Well, anything else about Wong Kar-wai as a person before we kind of jump into this first film as Tears Go By?
No, let's do it.
See, 海中的波涛滔滔不息 classic fade of hay.
Let's talk about As Tears Go By. So this came out in 1988. Kind of a broad strokes before we go into more details. It's a gangster movie. It's a crime thriller about a man named Wah and they're called little brothers in the gang. These are his kind of Fly is his little brother. Wah is played by Andy Lau and Fly is played by Jackie Chung. And I saw this compared to Mean Streets, the Scorsese mm-hmm. movie. And it does have a lot of similarities as far as the gangster side of things, because basically Fly is a wild card and he's a little too hot-headed and he's a little too crazy. And everyone knows something bad's going to happen with him eventually. And that's kind of the main plot as far as the crime story goes. And there's kind of dueling gangs and beef between different people and that sort of thing. And then at the same time, Wah has fallen in love with his cousin, the film starts when they're meeting, played by Maggie Cheung, who we're going to see a lot more of as we get through more of these films. But she plays Nyor, his cousin, and they have a romance that really blossoms throughout the movie. So that's kind of the broad strokes of it. What was your kind of initial impression? This is your first time watching this, right?
Yes.
Yeah. What'd you think?
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. You know, I think there was a period in my life when I watched a few Hong Kong crime films from this era. Mm-hmm. One of the most notable, probably like City on Fire, which is, I think, known in part for being the inspiration for Reservoir Dogs. And it's also is always interesting to see like young Maggie Cheung roles.
Yeah,
you know, she is retired now, but you know she's made a ton of films and she's in a ton of these Wong Kar-wai films. And you know she was also in the Police Story series with Jackie Chan. So she's
that's right,
kind of a star. I was trying to think of like when those came out in relation to this. But
the
I think
Police
this was
Story
like
movies. Let's see, I'll look it up.
Yeah. I want to say like this was like one of maybe her first break into like a dramatic role.
The first Police Story was 1985, so that's just three years before this.
Yeah. So yeah, and like just like seeing the colors and like just the way the film plays out. I was watching it again before we started, and I was noticing like from the beginning like the just use of music.
Mm-hmm.
It's there. It has like this really nice intro with like this bank of TV screens mm-hmm. or something overlooking the Hong Kong streets. And then like, but you see like hints of like the style that will develop over time. Mm-hmm. Both like with the use of like these flashbacks and flash forwards. So like there's a scene when it's at the very beginning when he's getting the call from his aunt that his cousin is coming, and it sort of briefly flashes to Maggie Cheung on a boat on a ferry while the conversation is still happening.
It's like a little nonlinear touch there.
So yeah, I think like all you can sort of see hints of the style, stylistic things that will develop in future films. So yeah, I think it was really exciting watch.
Yeah, I agree. I was really struck by the lighting through a lot of this. Like, so a lot of this takes place in his apartment, and she comes to stay because she has to go see the doctor that's in town. And there's just this really soft lighting and some neon colors that come in at different moments. And yeah, the music, as you mentioned, is like, it's kind of pop music for most of it. A lot of kind of 80s guitar kind of sounding things. But yeah, there's one of the early on scenes when I think there's kind of the first hint of kind of romantic tension between them. And it's just, it's like dusk or something, and like the lighting is just really perfect. It's framing their faces. Maggie Cheung is so gorgeous. What's his name? Andy Lau. Andy Lau is also a very handsome guy. So they're really good looking leads here. And the 80s music, it really made me think about like Drive or something, like Nicholas Winding Refn was probably influenced by this at some point. That's kind of a very similar vibe in some of the scenes. But yeah, I really like that. The camera work is really nice. There's moments, like there's a point which they're having a moment. They're about to leave for the evening. They're kind of been getting ready, and then Fly has gotten in some trouble, and there's like a chase through the streets actually, and they bust into the apartment. And so like before they get there, the camera's really still and kind of romantically framing them, and it's like you're getting that sense of longing and everything. And then in bust through the door, these two people who are like bleeding to death almost, and suddenly the camera just goes crazy, like swinging around the apartment, and so it really matches the energy, which, you know, matches the energy of course of the fight scene that we had just seen. So those things are kind of cut together and then come together in that moment. I thought that was a really striking moment of kind of camera work on it. Are there any like favorite shots or memorable moments visually for you in this?
Can we do spoilers? Because one of them is a spoiler.
Yeah, I think so. So spoiler alert, if you don't want to be spoiled on this movie, go check it out and come back. But I think this really isn't a movie that I don't think would be horribly affected by spoilers, really.
Yeah, I guess like to me, the two most memorable scenes both involve Maggie Cheung. One is her waiting at the, well, I guess there's three actually. One is her when she's running to the ferry depot or whatever. And there's a shot of her like running beside the bus. And that's when you realize like, oh, this is a full on romance. Yeah. And then there's one when she's waiting at the ferry port. Is it a port or a depot?
I'm not sure. I know what you mean though. Huh.
Well, she's waiting as everybody get, and like people come, they start getting off the ferry, and she's waiting to see if he is going to appear, and then he does. But just like, really, it was just like the waiting scene.
Yeah, there's a lot that, of like great.
I was struck with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say like close-ups of their faces, and there's several moments where they're waiting on the other person to show up from a travel, you know, from the ferry, from the bus or something. And what involves more longing than like waiting for the person you love? So that's important that it does that kind of thing a few times. I don't know, I guess this is a spoiler, so the romance develops and there's a kiss, a very memorable kiss that's honestly, it's really intense. It's like a really great moment. So there's like a whole musical sequence with Take My Breath Away, like a Chinese version or Cantonese probably, and it's but the chorus is in English. But that's like the most music video-esque sequence in this film is the Take My Breath Away part, and ends with this incredible, actually the music comes back a few times, but ends with this incredible kiss in a phone booth that I wrote in my notes, well, that's a hell of a kiss. But
I just love the unreality of films where there's a perfectly placed phone booth. But no, I love that. And then like I was gonna say, the last is just like the shot at the end when it flashes back to Maggie Cheung one last time at the very end. It's a memory. And then also just like, I guess some of my favorite shots in all films are just shots of people waiting. I like quiet things. I like when nothing happens.
You really get a sense of like the human parts of the story. And I guess we can avoid spoiling like the very ending, but there's the kiss scene, and then there's another moment of, again, it's a moment of kind of longing. Basically he's going up to, actually, so there's a whole great sequence, but she works in like a hotel restaurant, basically, like it's in the bottom of a hotel. And it's across the bay, or across Hong Kong, so they have to get there by ferry. And so but he lives kind of in the city, and so that's the kind of the distance, and they're always waiting for each other back and forth. But she gets him a hotel room or whatever, and he's like, "I'm going to go up. You sure I can't walk you home," or something like that. And then she's like, "No, I need to go home." And then she walks out of the frame, and then he says, "Could you maybe not go home?" And then the camera whips over to her really unexpectedly, and you see her reaction to that statement. I thought that was a great moment. And then it kind of leads to a moment again where he goes up the stairs and there's a question of what's she going to do next. And there's a great shot of her like trying to go up the stairs or not. So that's a really great moment too. There's a few moments where the camera kind of whips unexpectedly like that, that I thought were really nicely done. There's a couple other just like kind of shots. So I remember in Chungking Express, there's a lot of airplane imagery, and there's not a ton in this, but there is one moment where she's sitting and she throws a paper airplane just kind of out of nowhere, and it immediately cuts to an actual airplane. That was a great little jump cut. So that was a cool moment. There's a shot where it's a close up on his face during a fight scene. Actually, that whole fight scene, it's pretty early on. We get some of that motion blur, which I know is sort of a signature thing of Wong Kar-wai's as well. But they're fighting in this little cafe restaurant thing, and there's fluorescent lights all along the walls, and so the lighting is pretty striking, and we get this motion blur. Like they're smashing these light bulbs on each other as well. The action scenes are really pretty thrilling and sometimes pretty violent. And so that was a good one. And there's a close-up where he's just been hit over the head with something, and we see like a close-up of just his eyes and nose, and then suddenly one little blood trickle goes down in between his eyes. And it's like the only bright red thing in this otherwise kind of like green-gray kind of room. So that was a really good one as well. There's some other really great. So there's like a wedding scene, and they have kind of a verbal fight in front of some, it's on the roof of a building, which is important to the plot. But then there's a kind of a verbal fight in front of these bright red neon lights. And that's a really visually striking little moment there as well.
Yeah. This is not to do with the plot of the film, but it's striking to me that a rooftop wedding is seen as not an ostentatious display of wealth,
right?
Mm-hmm. Or something. Mm-hmm. I'm watching the knife fight now.
I've got the still got it on.
Yeah.
<That's> On that wedding thing. So yeah, the father-in-law is unhappy that, you know, and this is Fly, his little brother, has thrown this wedding for his little brother. So there's kind of like ranks within this gang, and he has not spent enough, and it's not lavish enough, and the father-in-law is horribly angry and embarrassed about this, which gets at an interesting thing about a lot of Asian cultures, but Chinese culture for sure, about saving face. And it's important to seem successful, I think, or like a show or your banquet would have made them happy. And so it's clear that on this rooftop, it's not, he didn't spend enough on this, and he feels shame over this as well. That's something that comes up over and over in the movie. And this may come up from time to time as we talk through these, but I actually spent some time living in China. So I have, I studied the culture a little bit as, like before I went and as I was there. So the saving face was always a big deal, I was an English teacher to my students, and, something that we had to think about as expats, as we were living there. But, so I'm curious to see how much of that kind of comes into these other films as well.
Where were you in China?
Yeah, we were in a city called Xi'an, which is not a super well-known. It's kind of central north. Among the really big cities, it's kind of the least, one of the less touristy ones. So like if people say that if Beijing is like Washington, D.C., because it's like the capital, then Shanghai is like New York, then Xi'an is kind of like Chicago. It's like a sort of a rough approximation of kind of the vibes of the different cities there. We really liked it. There's the most famous thing is the terracotta soldiers are there. So if you've seen those images, so it's about an hour outside of the city, but that's close to where that was discovered. And there's a bunch of Buddhist pagodas there that are kind of landmarks that are really beautiful there in Xi'an as well. So anyway, not very, very far from Hong Kong, and like the cultural differences, I'm sure will not always translate to my experience, but there are some things that felt familiar about that, like the saving face of that wedding scene was felt unique to the culture there. You know, like they wouldn't go down the same way if this was a bunch of Americans having a wedding or something, or even like in Europe somewhere. But it's such an important thing to display success, I think, and at least in my experience there. I don't want to like speak for all Chinese culture, because I really am not an expert, but I have a little bit of experience with it.
I was curious because I know there are a lot of Chinese films from the time where part of it has to do with people coming to Hong Kong from the mainland for you know, whatever reason, usually as a way of improving their economic status. And Maggie Cheung is in a couple of those. And I was wondering if this was related to that, but no. Like the island where she lives is still part of Hong Kong. So yeah. I was curious about
it's
that.
It's just like a cross from the main part of the city, I guess. Yeah, Hong Kong is such an interesting place, you know, especially as it's related to China. And we'll talk about that more. There was controversy. I mean, there's been a lot of controversy about that forever. But even while we were living there, there were some times that there were protests going on and our American teammates were saying, okay, this week we don't need to mention the word democracy at all. Like, we just need to really lay low. And I thought it was interesting, like, that affected us a little bit while we were there. But we were always kind of following the news and everything. But yeah, getting back to this movie, that's not really a great transition, but I just remembered another moment that was really striking camera wise was there's an ambush scene where we think, you know, we know that there's some danger that our two leads are going to be attacked at some point, but we don't think it's happening yet. And then they step outside to leave the place they are, and we see them kind of from a distance, and then we see, and like the camera kind of approaches them, and then we see some other people ambush them kind of from like far away from where we are as the camera. And then the camera rushes up at the same time. We realize, oh, we are in the point of view of one of these attackers. And I thought that was like a really surprising thing, because it's, it just feels like we're kind of watching them in this kind of paranoid moment. And then suddenly we're the attacker too. And we realize we've been in that. Usually when you're in a POV shot, you know it right away. But in this one, I didn't. And it really took me by surprise. That was a nice moment. And then there's a really great menacing shot of Tony, who's one of the rivals who they frequently are fighting with in this film. During that scene, he's got a baseball bat, and there's one moment where he's kind of alone in the frame making this face, and it's a really, really menacing, kind of memorable shot as well. Lots of great shots in this movie.
Yes. It's worth noting that Andrew Lau, who shot this film, I think Wong Kar-wai is most known for working with Christopher Doyle, which he would start with the next film, but this film was shot by Andrew Lau, who also went on to be a director and did the Infernal he worked on the Infernal Affairs films. Are you familiar with those?
I've heard of them, but I haven't seen them.
Okay. Yeah, the first one was remade as The Departed.
Okay. Yeah. I knew that was based on something. Yeah.
He also shot City on Fire, and so he has a lot of well-known Hong Kong films under his belt.
Wow. So some big names even early on. Yeah, big names kind of involved in this. So that's pretty cool. I guess we can kind of close to wrap up. Are there any other kind of signature Wong Kar-wai things in this? We mentioned the motion blur. I know that's going to come back. The use of pop music. All the longing moments. Anything else that stuck out to you as something to kind of keep an eye on as a through line?
There's a quote that someone said that his films are filled with characters who are nostalgic for a past they did not live, or something to that effect. And I feel like that is present in some of these characters. Or at least not to spoil the very, very end, but nostalgic for a past that could have been.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, again, not to spoil things, but one thing I read is that, like, in most of Wong Kar-wai's films, there's sort of romances that go wrong in some way that are not able to be fulfilled for one reason or another. And so I think that's probably, again, trying not to spoil things, mm-hmm. but that's the case here. And I think will continue to be in other films too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's As Tears Go By. I did want to mention the just as a sort of translation interest thing, the Chinese title is very different. And so actually the English title As Tears Go By, there's speculation that it's maybe named after the Rolling Stones song by the same name, but I don't think it's ever been confirmed. But the Chinese title is, or maybe Cantonese, no, I think it is Chinese, is Mongkok Carmen, which Mongkok is an area of Hong Kong that this film takes place. Like, apparently most of the kind of gang things happen in the Mongkok area of Kowloon, which is, so I think Kowloon is like an area of Hong Kong, and then Mongkok is like a bureau of that. I'm not exactly sure. Sorry, a borough of that. But then Carmen is a reference to the opera, like the famous opera that I don't know much about, but I know the name of it. And so it's saying, it's Mongkok Carmen is saying it's kind of like a Mongkok version of Carmen is what we're watching. Or it's almost like if you had like a New York Les Mis or something like that, you know, using the name of the place to kind of reference, we're going to set this kind of, and that kind of speaks as well to like the high and low, like here's this high art of this famous opera, but we're going to make it into this crime drama here in Hong Kong, and kind of blend those two things in an interesting way. So yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. So that's the title there. And that is As Tears Go By. Yeah, I think this is definitely worth watching. I've only seen this in Chungking Express now, but if this is kind of one of his quote unquote lesser works, then I'm just really excited to get into more, because I really like this a lot. Like, as a crime drama, this is like really stands out as far as the ones I've seen. So big fan of this, and sounds like you are too, Amaya, and I'm excited to move on to the next one next week.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to hear your take on Days of Being Wild. To me, I think that's the first one that is sort of like, okay, this is the Wong Kar-wai film. Mm-hmm. Like, if you only know him from his later works, I think that's the first one where it's like, okay, he's doing something different here in terms of the narrative structure.
Well, I'm really excited to see that. And it came out in 1990. So we're jumping forward a couple of years. And I guess we'll get into that next time. So thanks so much, Amaya, for joining us for all of these. We're going to be back for all six of these episodes. And I just am excited to have you back on the show for a while.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I guess we'll say bye-bye for now. And we'll talk to you next week. Talk to you later.
Huge thanks to Amaya Jones, and he will be back again next time as we look at Days of Being Wild, which is the next film in the World of Wong Kar-wai box set. I'm also planning on the next episode to review The Green Knight. This is the new film from director David Lowery and distributor A24. I'm very excited to see this movie. If you haven't seen the trailer, check it out. I'll link it in the show notes. It looks wild. Until then, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We've got a few years worth of episodes, and you can hear all of those in your podcast app of choice. Our theme music is by composer Paul Hunefeld. Learn more at appallingproductions.com. If you want to support Arthouse Garage, you can leave a rating or review in your podcast app, or you can buy an Arthouse Garage t-shirt at arthousegarage.com/shop. Stay in the loop about Arthouse Garage and the films we're covering by subscribing to our email newsletter. That's at arthousegarage.com/subscribe. Or you can always email me directly, andrew@arthousegarage.com. And of course, follow on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. Just search at Arthouse Garage in all those places, or find links in the show notes. And that will do it for this episode. Thank you again so much for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.